So the way it works with the grading is before I send you a formula sheet, I make out the exam and then I take the exam. And from what happens when I take the exam, I make modifications. But if it all goes okay, when I take the exam, that becomes the solution key. And of course, I have very exceptionally made mistakes. And when I do, it gets caught by the grader. And so the grader has to check me. And so sometimes they'll catch a mistake in the solution set, and I tell them to tell me so I can fix the solution set. If the grader makes that mistake, then usually there are enough students that get it right that after all the grader's like, wait a minute, rethinks it and figures it out. So normally we're pretty good. So this morning, Mayor came in with the stack of exams and told me about a mistake I made on the solution on one of the front page simple right-hand rule problems. And, I was like, oh, okay. And I looked and I checked that and said, no, the solution's right. And we triple-checked each other and finally decided the solution was right. So all this is a long story to say that on one of the parts on page one, she actually used the wrong solution and graded a bunch of you with an incorrect grade and now has to go back and fix that. So it'll happen today fast, but that's why I don't have the stack of papers for you. When it's those things that, there's always the option of saying, well, we'll just let it go and you tell me if it was graded wrong. But since many of you, of course, got it right, that means many of you got it wrong the first time she graded through. So it's enough of a change that we decided we should go ahead and make the change before I hand it back. So hopefully I will see those later today, and then what I will go through and do the statistics. I'll post the statistics, send you an email. Unfortunately, I still have to constrain you to come by and pick those up while I'm in my office because I can't just put them out for you to pick up according to college rules. So I'll do that, and you're welcome to pop by. If I have somebody in the office or whatever, just poke your head in and tell me what you want. I'll grab your exam. And, of course, I'll have them available for you in class on Tuesday if you don't manage to pick up for them. But I'll make... As soon as I have the statistics posted, I will make the Blackboard column available to you. So you can see at least what the nominal grade is that you got. Obviously, you need to check your exam and everything, and if it needs free grades or whatever, then you let me know. So, okay, sorry about that. So now we are message free. That is a new thing with an operating system for that projector. I think it warrants a pretty serious promotion. Okay. Yeah, they've got a new projector, I think. That's a lot brighter than it has been, right? Okay.
Or a new bulb, anyway.
Okay, so I hope you're starting to have fun with this. I actually think we're really in the middle of the midst of the fun stuff right now. So let me review a little bit about what we talked about last time. We defined vector operator, the divergence of the vector field, which is where you take the dot product of this vector operator del, which we have seen, with the vector field v. So since del is with vector components, basically the partial derivative with respect to each of the spatial directions, it looks like this. The divergence would look like this in Cartesian coordinates, but because what you're taking derivatives of is going to vary if you're in different coordinate systems, and you have to add all those little scale factors in, like those little sine thetas and r squared sine thetas you see in spherical polar, the divergence looks different in different coordinate systems. It looks substantially more complex if you're in spherical polar coordinates, for example, but it's really the physics of it is the same thing. But in Cartesian coordinates, it looks like this. You're taking the dot product, so you take the x component of del and the x component of the vector field, and you multiply them by each other, and you add to them the same thing in the other field. So what the physics intuition is of the divergence is it is a measure of the degree to which the vector field is diverging from the point at which you're taking that divergence. So you have a very large divergence if, for example, you were looking at the flow of water out of a faucet in a pool of water or something like that. Then clearly the water is going to be moving away. This divergence would be very positive, this divergence would be very negative, and this divergence would be zero. So it's sort of the degree to which you have sources and sinks
of the field that you're looking at. Any questions on that? Okay, so another vector operator we talked about was the curl of the vector field, and in this case, you are taking the cross product of the vector del, the vector operator del with the vector field, and you evaluate it the way you would normally evaluate a cross product. It's a little bit weird because you have these funky operators in here. So this now is different from the divergence in that it's not measuring the degree to which the field is diverging, but it's measuring the degree to which it's circulating. And so this would have a very non-zero curl, and this would have a curl of zero. And if you had these lines just going on radially, for example, it would also have a curl of zero. Okay?
So you'll see these vector operators
in all areas of physics. If you had fluid dynamics or take fluid dynamics, you'll certainly see them. So these are nothing special in electromagnetism about them, except they're very useful. So in order to transform Maxwell's equations from the integral form, which we're sort of used to, into the differential form, we make use of Stokes' theorem and this theorem, which goes by many names, I guess, which relates these integral pieces to sort of these differential pieces. So if I have a vector field and I dot the vector field and I go around the loop, that's equivalent to the integral of the cross product in every little differential area element within the area that's subtended by that loop. So if you take the dot product of the curl and do that integral, these two are equivalent. Similarly, I can relate the divergence to the dot product of the vector field over the area. Here we have the volume integral over the divergence of the field throughout that volume. And here we have an integral over the surface of that volume where we take the dot product of the vector field. I don't think that these necessarily are intuitively obvious, at least not to me, but proofs are done, certainly in some math classes. You can find physics books that have them, but it's not worth our time, so I'm not worrying about it here. All right, so with those in hand, then we take the integral form of Maxwell's equations on the left-hand side. This is really how we, in a sense, how we learn the physics, because it seems to fit what we can picture and what we see in the lab more easily. So Gauss's law, if you take Gauss's law, which is on the left-hand side, the integral of the vector field E over the area, then you can use the divergence theorem and And you can rewrite this like so. You can rewrite this piece as the divergence of E over the volume integral, and now you have these two integrals over the same volume, so you can extract L by E as equal to rho. You can do the same thing for the equation, the integral equation that basically tells you that the Gauss's law version for the magnetic field is zero, because we don't have such a thing as a point charge for magnetism. So when we talk about the magnetic monopole density, or magnetic monopoles enclosed over epsilon naught, which you might put in there, it's always zero, because we don't seem to see magnetic monopoles in reality. Again, we use the divergence theorem, and we get that the divergence of D is zero. If we take Ampere's law, which has a term here, which was what Maxwell added in, Maxwell's displacement current, we can rewrite Ampere's law in terms of area integrals,
by using, by converting this term using Stokes' theorem into that. And so now I have the three terms integrated over the same area, and I can extract out the pieces that are internal integral, and I get the cross product of D is mu zero times the current density plus mu zero times epsilon times the derivative of E with respect to time. Similarly, if we go and look at Faraday's law of induction, we can use Stokes' theorem to rewrite the left-hand side into a cross product over the area, and now I have two area integrals, and I extract the pieces that are inside that, and I get the cross the curl of E is equal to minus the derivative of T with respect to time. Yeah.
What happened to epsilon not in Gauss's law?
It got dropped.
But it ought to be there.
Okay, so intuitively, we're in a region where we have no current density. Then this says if we're in a region where I have a changing electric field, I will basically get circulating in that region a magnetic field. And if I have a changing magnetic field, I will have circulating in that region a changing electric field. So these two equations are time-dependent coupled equations in D&D. And they sort of tell you a B will induce an E, which will induce a B, etc. So now what I want to do is to rip these apart and see if we can understand more about the essence of what these equations are showing. These are general equations, okay? Any E and D system, these hold true. To get the intuition that we want to have for what's going on, we will put some limits on the physical system so that it is easier to understand and grasp what's going on with all those boundary conditions. In electromagnetism, from here on out, you're going to talk a whole lot about boundary conditions. And if I start giggling when I talk about boundary conditions, it's because my graduate professor in Columbia always would go, boundary conditions, in some weird way that we'd always just laugh. So whenever I say it, I'd start to laugh. I don't know why. Conditioning, I think. So here we go. No boundary conditions yet. But before I can talk about ripping these puppies apart, we need to define another vector operator that we'll be using along the way. And we call it the Laplacian. So let me first talk about what we mean when we talk about the Laplacian of a scalar field. So the Laplacian of the scalar field is a little bit like taking a second derivative, but instead of using second derivative, you're using the del. So we give it the symbol del squared times t. I'll call the scalar field t. And what we mean by this is that it's the divergence of the gradient of t. T is a scalar field. So if we take the gradient of t, we get a vector, remember, and we can take the dot product of a vector with a vector. When you take the dot product of a vector with a vector, we get a scalar. So it's a little bit weird. We start out with a scalar field, and in some sense we now take the gradient, get a vector, do a dot product, and now we end up with another scalar. And we call it the Laplacian. So let's look at what that is. So we are taking the divergence of the Laplacian. Or the dot product of the Laplacian with
the gradient of t, so that's going to be
we're taking the dot product of this with that, so that means that we take this term and it will now effectively operate on this term. I hat dot I hat is just 1, so I end up with the second derivative of t with respect to x. Similarly, I'll have the second derivative of t with respect to y for a second term that comes from the j's, and the third term is similar for z. And the cross terms, this I dots into that j, that's 0, because I and j are orthogonal.
So this turns out to be equal to... You okay with that?
Yes.
It is.
The usual answer.
I just admitted you're right. You okay with that? All right. We also define something which is called the Laplacian of a vector field.
And here, you have to pay some attention because that arrow now means something, because what you get is different. This is no longer the scalar field we've got there. And we define this as being the Laplacian of the scalar value of v in the x direction as the x component of the Laplacian of the vector field, and then the Laplacian of the scalar field, which is the y component of the vector field, v in the j hat direction, plus the Laplacian of the scalar Laplacian of the z component of the vector field in the k hat direction.
Right, so that's what you mean when you talk about the Laplacian of a vector field. Okay?
So then you say, why do I care? Here's why you care. Let us take one of Maxwell's equations. Let us take the one that we extract from Ampere's law. In the differential form, we have written it as this. The curl of B is equal to mu 0 times the density, the current density, plus mu 0 times epsilon naught times the derivative of the electric field with respect to time. And let us say that we are in a region with no current. So that's just for simplicity, but it's also a bit of a boundary condition. We're specifying that we're going to only worry about a situation with no current at the moment. When we do that, then the current density is 0, so that just gets rid of that term. All right. And now what I'd like to do is to take the curl of both sides. So just like I can take the derivative of both sides in an equation, I can take the curl of both sides in an equation. So let's do that. And we end up on the left-hand side, we're going to take the curl of B. And on the right-hand side, we get mu zero times epsilon naught times the derivative with respect to time of the curl of E. All right? I don't want to derive this identity for you, but you can derive an identity, a vector calculus identity, which is that the curl of a vector quantity is equal to the gradient of the divergence of that vector quantity minus the divergence of the gradient of that vector quantity. The divergence of B is zero. That is one of Maxwell's equations. So this term is zero. The divergence of a gradient of a vector field is the divergence of a gradient. In this case, it's scalar. And in this case, we're dealing with a vector field, so we have to use the vector form of Laplace. So this is equal to the Laplacian of the vector field B. So that tells us that the Laplacian of B is equal to mu zero times epsilon naught, coming from up here. So I'm now back up here. This now has magically transformed into the Laplacian of B, and I'm pulling this term down. But, so we have mu zero epsilon naught times the derivative with respect to time of the curl of E. And the curl of E is the minus time derivative of B from the law of induction. So I substitute that in. This is minus mu zero times epsilon naught times the derivative with respect to time of the derivative with respect to time of B, which is minus mu naught epsilon naught times the second derivative with respect to time of B. Okay? So I just rewrite that, and note that I have the B vector field now on both sides.
Should it be negative Laplacian?
Should it be what?
Should it be negative Laplacian of B in the magic equation?
Yeah, given what I wrote here. Possible I dropped a minus sign somewhere.
Well, because it's the word homomorphic. Right now we have a negative speed. I imagine this.
Yeah, I think I did drop a sign somewhere, and I think you're right. Right now, we have an imaginary speed of light that we don't want.
The very bottom row of the previous page should be negative, possibly. So the negative.
That page where you switch from green to blue.
Yeah.
The blue should be negative.
That should be negative.
And then carry the blue
one. Yeah. Okay. Good. Man, you guys are great. How about that? You're depriving all your classmates of the exercise of trying to figure out what the hell I was doing when they look back at their notes. It's part of the learning process. All right. So we have that sign ironed out. So what we have is a vector field here and here, and we can take each component of the vector field and set them equal to each other. So what we have then would be the x component of this thing. So that's a scalar Laplacian. We have those three pieces. And now we can take one of these. So let's take this one, for example. And expand that, so that would be the second derivative of b in the x, in the x with respect to x, plus the second derivative of by with respect to y. I'm sorry, second derivative of b in the x with respect to y. Plus the second derivative of b in the x with respect to z. So what I'm doing here is I've taken, this is now scalar Laplacian, which is written like so. The scalar field that you're taking it of is the b field in the x direction. By b in the x, I already tell you direction, so this is just a magnitude, so it's just a scalar. This whole thing is then equal to what you have on the right-hand side. Okay. So remember our starting point with that before we rewrote it into this term. Remember that this we took that Ampere's law, the differential form. We rewrote it with the vector calculus and sort of ripped it apart. And now we really have three equations, this one being the one for b and the x. We have a similar equation for b and the y and a similar equation for b and the z. All right. Now what I want to do is to go back to... We go back to Maxwell's equations. So what we just did was we took this equation and we ripped it apart into that form.
And we did it in a current-free area, so this goes away. Now what I'd like to do is to do the same thing, but now do it for this equation that basically has the same form.
we're going to take... The curl of E is equal to minus the time derivative of B with respect, derivative of B with respect to time. And we'll end up with the Laplacian of the E field is mu zero times epsilon naught times the second derivative of E with respect to time. And hopefully there's not a minus sign floating around. So here's the one in B, there's the one in E. And these are the ones in vector form, but let me remind you that if we take an equation which is a 1D wave that propagates on a string, it has the form and at some point in your mechanics, you should have extracted, you know, take a harmonic form and looked at the speed with which that wave shape travels on the wave and you extract the velocity. So if you have a 1D wave propagating on a string, you basically have a second derivative spatial piece equivalent to a second derivative time piece with this constant, and that constant involves the speed of the propagation. So if you look at what we have up here, we have a second derivative spatial piece is equal to a constant times a second derivative time piece. And E and B separate. So for each of these, what we basically have are wave equations where this mu zero epsilon naught combination can tell us the speed of the propagation. So when you look at that, the velocity of propagation of the waves in E and B that these equations are telling us that we have are equal to 1 over the square root of mu naught times epsilon naught, if we're doing this in a vacuum. And if you go and you plug those numbers in, you'll find that that's equal to the speed of light. Okay? So by ripping apart these equations, Maxwell's equations, we find that E and B are wave-like phenomena. We haven't really invoked any sort of boundary conditions, so just that we're in a current free region for right now. And we have wave equations, and if you extract the velocity of the waves in E and B, you get the velocity of light. Okay? And except for the lack of current, this is now a general result. Any questions? Did I drop any more signs? Okay. We can actually say a whole lot more, but to say a lot more, it's good to put ourselves in a physical situation where we simplify a little bit. Because right now, we have lots of components in all different directions, so it's a little hard to visualize. So what I'd like to do is to set up a boundary condition which will simplify things for us. So let's imagine that we have a light bulb somewhere, and this light bulb does what light bulbs do. It's on, it sends light out in all directions. And so if we make the assumption that whatever is happening with E and B here
if it travels out at the speed of light and it's somehow self-propagating, which these equations basically tell you that they are, one reduces the other. There's a couple of differential equations that we'll just say, okay, let it be light. And so now what I want to do is let's take a source of light, and light does what light does. If I form light right here, I'll get a spherical wave going in all directions. I'll have light going out in all directions. And the world is complicated. Okay? So a way to make it less complicated is to stand way over here. So we have our eyeball, staring this way. But what I'd like to say is that this now is we are very far away. So what we mean by being very far away, if somebody says, okay, we look at a distant source or you're very far away, you mean that the spherical waves that are coming out at you, now the sphere is so big it looks planar to you. So if I tell you it is a plane wave, or I tell you it's a distant source, or you're very far away, that's all saying the same thing. So I set up a coordinate system where we are far away, but we are far away in the x direction. So the boundary conditions we're going to choose is that we're very far away. And what that means is that this wave front is planar. So it may vary, but it will have to vary along x because it looks like a big plane coming at me. So when we say it's far away and we're going in the x direction, what we say is that, for example, the electric field is equal to a function of x and t. And the other boundary conditions that I want to put in play is I want to say that we have no charge in the space where we're looking at this. So rho is equal to zero, and we'll say that j is also equal to zero, so I have no current. So we're in a vacuum. We're looking at a point source of light very far away, and we're in a vacuum. Okay? So, we know from Maxwell's equations, basically Gauss's law takes the form here. But in this case, because we have no charge, this is equal to zero. So if the divergence of E is equal to zero, we know that this is true. That is the divergence of E, and that's equal to zero. If you think about this, if E is only a function of x and t, then E might have a y component and it might have a z component that varies as you go along x, but it can't change with respect to y or z, because E is only a function of x. So that means these two terms are zero. So that tells you that E in the x is constant for all x. And I'm going to choose Ex equal to zero.
for simplicity. Okay? So there's no component of the electric field in the x direction, which means there's no component of the electric field in the longitudinal direction,
or in the direction of propagation. We aren't learning anything about E, Y, and E, Z. What this means is that if there is an electric field that exists here, then we know that that E is transverse. So a way to rewrite that would be that E is equal to I'm going to choose
whatever the direction of E happens to be, I will now choose that to be sort of the Y direction. So we'll just say that the physics way to say that is at no loss of generality, we will choose the transverse direction to be along the J. When we talk about light,
this is also known as the direction of polarization.
Direction of polarization is the direction of the electric field in the propagating light. Okay. So we will choose it to be along J for now.
Okay, so for the next step, I want to take this equation, which is the curl of E is equal to minus the time derivative of B. The curl of E is a vector.
B is a vector. I can take the x component of the curl and set it to I can take the x component of the curl of E and set it equal to the x component of B.
So when I do that, and remember what curl is this three funky terms that you get when you do that determinant with the del operator and with the vector field. So you end up with these three equations, if I didn't drop something. Okay. So that equation then should be equivalent to those three equations. And now let's look at these terms. E is a function of x. EY and EZ might be non-zero, but they will only change as a function of x. So what this means is if I look at the derivative of EY or EZ as a function of y or z, they'll be zero, because these components can only change with x by the boundary conditions of the plane wave. So this is zero, and that is zero. What that's telling you is that the time derivative of the B field in the x direction is zero. That tells you that the B field component along the direction of propagation, again, has to be constant. And we'll just choose it to be zero, right? Okay. So what this tells us is that Bx is constant in time E. By our boundary condition, we have said that E is along the J. So this term is zero. There's no Z component to E. And E X we said was zero. So I think that is zero. So this tells us that B in the Y is constant in time. Bx is constant in time and we set it to zero, tells us that the B field is also transverse to propagation, just like the B field was. Okay? Remember that at no loss of generality, we said the E field is along the Y direction. When we say that, then that's what makes this term go away. And when that happens, it tells us that B in the Y is zero, or constant in time, we'll set it to zero. B in the X is constant in time, B in Y is constant in time. Combine these two, it tells us that B has to be along the Z direction. It is transverse, and in fact, if we say E is along Y, B is along Z. So E and B are orthogonal to each other. E in the X, we said that E is along the Y, so this is zero. Here we have E in the Y, and that can happen, and it can change as a function of X, so this term is non-zero. B is along the Z potentially, this term is non-zero. So this equation actually holds true. So what we have is that that B is time dependent, okay, so it's non-zero, and it's perpendicular to E. And they're both transverse. Okay?
at right angles to one another, and they are time dependent, and they are transverse to the direction of propagation.
We also know from earlier that they basically satisfy these 1D wave equations. All right, so we want to take advantage of that. So if they satisfy 1D wave equations, then I know that harmonics will satisfy these equations. So I can write an equation for E or B in terms of harmonic functions. So let's just do that. We have said that E is along the j-hat direction. So that means E has only a y component. So I'll say E in the y. It has to be a function of the direction of propagation and time. So it's a function of x and t. Yikes. We will give it a magnitude. I'll just call E0y. I'll choose a harmonic function. I'll choose cosine. If it's harmonic, then I will have... it has to propagate in time, so I have to have a spatial and time piece within the harmonic function. So it'll be kx minus omega t, and I'll give it a phase, which tells us our starting place. This k is what we call the wave number. K is equal to 2 pi over the wavelength for the wave. So this is just like you did on strings. Remember that for a wave propagating on a string, it's y is equal to cosine of kx minus omega t. It's going one way, and it's kx plus omega t going the other way. So if this is 2 pi over lambda, then whenever you go a distance x along the direction of propagation, which is equal to the wavelength of whatever this is, if it's a wave, then you increment this by an integral of 2 pi, and that gives you the repetition for the cosine function. And if you look at the time dependence, omega is the same thing, except it's the frequency. And it's equal to 2 pi over the period for the wave. Okay. And then this last piece is what we call the phase angle. And it is set by the initial condition. And so for this particular problem, we'll just set it to 0 for now. If we were doing a real problem, we might actually be given information that allows us to determine what that phase angle is, and we have to use it. But at no loss of generality, we'll set it to 0 right now. Actually, you can set anything to 0 as long as you say those magic words. If you say it fast and move to the next slide, it doesn't actually matter whether it makes any sense or not, because everybody will just assume you knew what you were talking about. All right. So let us look at this now.
We have an equation here. Let's use it.
So we have that from above. So this is coming from here. So that means that B in the Z is equal to the negative integral, time integral, of the derivative of Ey with respect to x. Now we have an equation for Ey here, and we can take the derivative of this with respect to x. So b in the z is equal to, so the derivative of cosine is minus sine, and we're taking the derivative with respect to x, so we pull a k out. So we get, this becomes the integral of k times e0y times the sine of kx minus omega t, and remember that phi has disappeared because we just said it was zero. And the integral of a sine is a cosine, and we have to pull out a 1 over omega because we're taking the derivative of this. So this becomes k over omega times e0y times the cosine of kx minus omega t. I have another minus sign that comes when I pull the omega out. So for once, I don't think I dropped the sign.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So BZ is non-zero. So remember, E and B are transverse, so it's going in the x direction. And if we define E to be along J, then it tells us that we have a non-zero B, but it's along the Z direction. Note that their amplitudes are different. Also note that they are in phase.
Omega is equal to 2 pi over lambda over 2 pi over the period, which is equal to the period divided by lambda, which is the speed of propagation of the wave. So this turns out to be equal to 1 over c, right? Lambda divided by the period will be the speed of propagation. So we have that the amplitudes of E and B are related. B in the Z is equal to 1 over C times E in the Y. And now we have a lot of information. We know that E and B are coupled. They are time dependent. The magnitude of E is equal to C times the magnitude of B. And that they are in phase, both in time and space. Okay? And we also know that they are transverse and mutually perpendicular. You all right with that? So I have a coordinate system, and what we've said is that the electric field in the y is non-zero, it's a function of x and t, and we say that it's e0y times the cosine of kx minus omega t, and we've set phi equal to zero. And when we have that, then we know that bz, which will be a function of x and t, is equal to e0y over c times the cosine of kx minus omega t. So let's draw that. E is a cosine curve in space and time. So what that means is, as you move along in x, E may vary, and it has to vary as a cosine along the j direction. So if you were to look at the vector field E as a function of just space for the moment, let's freeze time, then as a function of space along all the infinite planes along x, the sandwich of planes, okay, you will see the magnitude of the electric field change, well, the vector field changing, and it will change like a cosine if you were to walk along the x direction here, okay, you would see, you would measure E to be big, and then it's going to get smaller, and then it will reverse direction and get bigger, and then as you keep walking, it gets smaller, and then it reverses direction and it gets bigger. Okay, so that would be the form of the electric field as a function of space if you freeze time. Now remember, if we release time, this whole form moves like a wave on a string, and if you stay in one place, you will see the time repetition of the electric field with the period, characteristic period. Okay? As the wave moves past, you'll see the electric field up, and then it gets to zero, flips direction, comes down, and comes back up. Okay? So that's what the electric field should look like for whatever this weird phenomenon is. And if we have that happening, we have a non-zero B field in the Z direction in phase. And it has a magnitude that's determined, which I'll sort of ignore for right now. But the magnitude is, at a moment, if E is along the positive Y direction, I know that B is along Z. B has the same wavelength, it's in phase. So that means that B has to look like this. Well, maybe not quite like that. Something like that. So B is oscillating in the ZX plane. And it's very easy to look at this. Oh, now it's light because I've thrown a nice photon. I have this nice little packet. That's not the way it works. These are vectors. If I'm standing in a certain place along x, these vectors represent the fields in the plane, the infinite plane. It is not confined in a packet. Remember, we're dealing with a plane wave going through. But what I have is these two vectors oscillating in phase, and this whole shape goes along the x direction at the speed of light, but basically you have this oscillating thing. So if you think about it in terms of space, right, I have an E vector and a B vector. If I keep walking, they go in phase and they do this, right? Maybe that. If you stand in one place, it's like a
an old bad disco dance, right? You just stand there, if you're sensitive to the E's and B's, as the wave passes through you, it's doing this.
It's sort of hard to visualize, and it's really hard to draw. If my Java applet worked, there. It's not a packet.
So these vectors represent the entire plane, okay?
So now if you look in the plane you will be seeing instantaneously
the E field and the B field that are pictured at that moment. And it is changing in time as the wave propagates through to you. And remember that E and B are totally coupled and self-inducing as a function of time. So the thing basically self-propagates. So
I'm sure many of you have been very bothered by the fact that when we looked at relativity, we found that addition of speeds are relative, because that's what Newton says. And then you go and you look at light, and you find that light travels the same speed in all reference frames, and it's like, wait a minute, how does it do that? I think you can still worry about it a little bit, but if you think about what's happening with relative speeds, if I take a rock and I throw it in a pond, that wave is in a preferred reference frame in a sense. It's propagating in a material, and you're moving with respect to that material. And that wave has to be in the material because it is that material that's doing the waving, if you want to think about it. Here, it's sort of a different thing because E and B basically just induce each other as they go. I don't necessarily have to have E and B oscillating in something, because if I have an E oscillating, it will induce a B, and that induces an E. So this can propagate in a vacuum, which sets it apart from other waves.
But if it propagates through medium, doesn't that change the speed of the wave?
Yeah.
So would that kind of say that it's dependent on medium is traveling through?
Oh yeah, it is. If it's going through a medium, but then we're in the vacuum. And it does change. That's where a lot of the richness comes from. As you can imagine, the strength of E and B change as I'm in a material, right? Because now I have to worry about permittivity and permeabilities. And so different materials have different permittivities and permeabilities. So as you can imagine, when you then calculate the field equation, the wave equations like we had, where we extracted the velocity of the light to be this 1 over the square root of epsilon naught mu naught, it won't be that, it'll be 1 over epsilon mu, and different. So you do get the speed of light in the material being different from what it is in the vacuum. And that's where all the fun starts, because that's how you can get refraction and other things. So you have a plane wave that enters, that hits an interface to a material. As the wave hits the material, this piece of the wave is now going slower than that piece of the wave. And basically, when we look at it carefully, that will cause it to bend, so you can extract Snell's law. We may even know that. Look at that. Yeah, so a lot of the richness happens when you do that.
So the plane now is sort of showing you how E and B are evolving in time in that plane. You can look at how it evolves in space by moving the plane around. Okay, so the evolution will be depending on the wavelength. We haven't specified the frequency. So if I specify the frequency, I can change things and make it look. I can give it a shorter wavelength, which has a higher frequency.
And Maxwell's equations doesn't say anything about there's a limit in the frequency range. So I can have
our wavelength is really long, our wavelength is really short. Maxwell's fine with that. This is totally cool, isn't it? Yeah. So this came out of me trying to make drawings and trying to dance them out in front of class. And the software company was talking to me, and we talked to the deans out of some money to get the software written. And basically, I told them, this is what I want, and they did agree. I love this. And if you think this one's cool, wait till we get into polarization. It's just great stuff. So anyway, this Java applet is on the web if you want to look at it. Okay, so I'm out of time today, and we will continue studying the nature of light next time. And I will hopefully get your exam grades and exams available for you soon. So have a great weekend.